Okay, so looking at chapter 15 now, and okay, so because of this option to redo this exam, not exactly the same questions, but same chapters of topics to choose from. Chapter 16 is skippable, so I will take the opportunity to skip it. Of course, you're welcome to read about it. So when we're on day 26 next Tuesday, we'll be at chapter 17, getting into Taylor's theorem. Then there's more days of class, right? Trade-off, and what do we have time for? And so I would really like to get to chapter 22, sequences of, and series of functions, just to talk about interesting concepts of not just sequences of numbers and series of numbers converging, but talking about functions doing the same thing. So that we'll get to in chapter. We can get to that, chapter 22. We just have to skip chapter 21. Chapter 19 gives a formal definition of integrals in terms of Riemann sums. Chapter 20 is the fundamental theorems of calculus. Okay. Do here. Now, I was thinking about my thoughts on chapter 15, and so there's kind of two big results. There's the mean value theorem, right? And
thank you.
It's proved using a Rolle's theorem, right? So, 1a. And then we have L'Hopital's rule. Remember? Okay. Now, I proved this one slightly differently than the book, so I can do it with weaker hypotheses than the book uses. I use an inverse function. Well, actually, back up. It's nested deeper than that. Okay, so this I prove pretty much like the book does, using Cauchy's mean value theorem. And how do I prove Cauchy's mean value theorem? Well, there I need some inverse function facts. Okay. So the two main goals I think I see for this chapter is understanding why L'Hopital's rule works. That understanding it, you can have an intuitive understanding with some pictures, but how to understand why it works in general under some set of hypotheses, you need some proof from those hypotheses so that you know for sure that even if it's some crazy picture that you can't imagine, if it satisfies the hypotheses, you're sure it will satisfy the conclusion. Same for the mean value theorem. So the idea is understand why these are true under some set of fairly general hypotheses, right? Intuitively, you know, there's not any controversy, right? The mean value theorem is kind of, somebody gives a pictorial representation of it, you know, it has to be true. The objection is why does it have to be true in general? Maybe there's some curve that you haven't imagined yet that doesn't fit your proof by picture. Right? Mean value theorem says if I have a function that's continuous on a closed interval a to b, we better have a less than b to make this interesting. Right? And then we need the fact that it is differentiable. On the interior. Right? So it doesn't have to be differentiable at the endpoints. Like this could be a vertical tangent line here if you wanted. That would be okay. It just has to be differentiable, in the interior of the interval. So, given all those things, then we claim that there's at least one point in the middle. There may be more than one. Right? Where the slope of that secant line that I've drawn, right? So assuming the curve is f and that line there is just a straight line from here at one point on the graph to another point. Let's call this line's slope m, okay? So to be precise, the slope is just f of b minus f of a over b minus a. So the claim is that there is a point strictly in between a and b where if you plug it into the function, the tangent line will have that same slope. Like somewhere about here, for example. That could be the C. Right? There could be more than one, right? Like in this picture, I think there's one somewhere around here. Of course, the physical interpretation is even more plausible. You say something like, if you drove, 100 miles in 2 hours, your average speed was 50 miles an hour. So there was actually a moment in time when the speedometer on your car read 50 miles an hour. Very plausible. But we have some abstract definitions of what is a continuous function. Right. What is it? Does it mean to be differentiable at a point? So, given those abstract hypotheses, are they enough to actually prove that no matter what weird function that satisfies the hypotheses, can we get this to be true? So, That's the idea with the mean value theorem. And
L'Hopital's rule. Says
you need some kind of hypotheses on it. So there's a whole bunch of different cases of L'Hopital's rule, because you can talk about the zero over zero case, the infinity over infinity case, and then you want to take a limit, right? Are you talking about a limit as x goes to infinity, or x is the input? A limit as x goes to a. A limit as x goes to a from the right, from the left. So here's one case. Okay. So let's say I have two reals alpha and beta, and then let's say that f and g are continuous and differentiable on that interval from alpha to beta. What else do I need? Let's say we're in the zero over zero case, right? Let's suppose that f of x goes to zero and g of x goes to zero as we approach alpha from the right. And remember, L'Hopital's rule is how you, if you know the limit of f prime over g prime, then if f and g tend to zero, then the limit of f over g is the same. Okay, so we need f prime over g prime to make sense. So I'm going to assume that g prime is not zero for all x in this interval alpha to beta. And finally, that f of x over g of x goes to some real number L as we approach alpha from the right. So if you have all that, then I claim that the f over g also goes to L. Now, in various cases, you can make a convincing picture for this idea. What are these lines giving you? you have a, if you have y is 0 here, and we go over by some distance, looks like it would be x minus a, or x minus alpha, sorry. Then this should be b times x minus alpha if we go along this line. And here we should have a times x minus alpha. Okay. Now the ratio of those two things b over a is the L. So maybe you imagine now some graph or some function whose slope is getting pretty close to b. So the idea is, over here you have f prime, and it's roughly the same as, the slope of the graph of f is about the same as b. And, moreover, as we get close over here, it looks like f should actually be if f prime is close to b, it also looks, and then if your f right here, if f tends to 0 over there, as I've drawn, then we should have that f is roughly b times x minus alpha. The idea is the graph of f is well approximated by this tangent line. Function g, whatever does whatever it does, and it's like this. The idea is that if g prime is close to that number a, then and the value of g goes towards 0, then you would expect g to be well approximated by that tangent line. I hope the approximation will get really, really good when we go there. So if you have these two approximations, you divide them into this approximation, your answer.
That's the kind of picture that motivates this. Imagine a very simple case where it's just two lines, two linear functions that both have the same y-intercept, and so you're imagining approximating.
And again, an actual proof will have to work with hypotheses that don't prescribe those particular pictures. So you have to actually show that, you know, even if it's not exactly like that picture, it still works. Let's see, something's missing on this. So the ratio of the derivatives goes to L, and the functions both go to 0, then the ratio of the functions also goes to L. Provided you have a few, you know, reasonable things, you know, like you need them to be, you need them to be, say, continuous and differentiable at these x's near alpha to the right that we're looking at. Right. And you don't want to have, and this hypothesis, you could argue that g prime not being zero is redundant, because if this is actually even defined near L, Some people would say this limit isn't even well defined unless it's defined for all x in your alpha to the right. But just whatever convention you're using, I want to be clear that we do need to avoid a bunch of divisions by zero arbitrarily close to alpha. So that's why I have a whole interval here where g prime is assumed to be not zero.
There are some weird counterexamples that people have cooked up when you do allow g prime to be zero. Okay. So those are the two goals of this chapter. So did anybody read chapter 15? Have any comments or questions about it? Ask you a question. What is the difference between the mean value theorem and Rolle's theorem? What is R-O-L-L-E? I'm not sure if I should pronounce it Rolle or Roller. What does that theorem say? Says if I ended up back where I started, then somewhere I must have turned around. More precisely, if F is continuous on closed interval AB, and it is differentiable at all the interior points, and the function starts at zero and ends at zero, then it has a horizontal tangent line somewhere in between. So the difference between that and the mean value theorem is it's really just a special case, right? Imagine I shift this graph around. Shift's the right word. If we just take the function that describes this line, say, and you subtract it from f, you get a graph that starts and ends at value 0. Right?
So it's really just a special case. If the function is continuous from here to here, what can it do? Right? Go down, it could go up. But if it ever is not 0, right? If say it goes negative or if it goes positive, right? It's gotta come back to 0 eventually, so it's gotta turn around, right? There's a horizontal tangent line. There's another horizontal tangent line. In my case, I drew a function that turned around twice. Could turn around many times. Even infinitely many times. But we're guaranteed that it'll turn around at least once. There's kind of a trivial case. What if the function was always 0? It's just a horizontal line. Well, then every point would be a horizontal tangent. It would have slope 0 everywhere. The interesting case is when it's actually not always 0, but yet it still has to have at least one point of horizontal tangency. Proof is going to use there's a reason we assume continuity there, right? I could give you counterexamples if it wasn't continuous. So, before we go into a proof, maybe just see something. What would happen if I had, even if I keep differentiability interior, let's say I lose continuity at one of the endpoints, right? I could do something ridiculous like this. No horizontal tangents now. Slope can always be 1, except there. So you really do need the continuity hypothesis. What if you're not differentiable everywhere in the interior? Well, then there's other ways to cheat, right? Something like this. No horizontal tangents there.
At all. So you see why we need continuity.
How do we use continuity to actually prove Rolle's theorem? What is continuity bias? Notice that here the y value is at its lowest, and here the y value is at its highest. Whereas in this picture, there's no highest y value. Right? It gets as close as you want to whatever this height is, but it never reaches it. Instead, you drop down there. Continuity plus a closed interval domain buys us the extreme values theorem. Maximum, and there's a minimum. I think that's 13.3.
Okay.
Now, what you want is a point strictly between A and B. So you want to use either P or Q. That should be where the horizontal tangent is. Maybe one of these points that you get happens to be an endpoint. Well, the argument is they can't be both an endpoint unless it's a trivial case, right? If they're both not in the interior, if P and Q are both endpoints of the interval, okay, well, we know the function is zero at the endpoints by hypothesis. But if the maximum and minimum values are both zero, then all the values are zero, right? The maximum value is the greatest value. The minimum value is the least value. Right? So if the maximum are at the endpoints, then the function is just zero. But if the function is always zero, well, then it's easy to see that the derivative is always zero. So you can pick your interior point to be whatever you want. If the function is just horizontal, then you can pick any C in the middle and it'll work. So there's nothing to do there. Right? So the only interesting cases are where one of these is actually in the interior. Okay. Case where neither are in the interior. So let's suppose that one and both are in the interior. So those are overlapping cases, right? I mean, because they could both be in the interior. P and Q could both be in the interior. Like in this example, you know, P would be here and Q would be here. But regardless, as long as one of them's in the interior, I can use that as the place of horizontal tangency. So that's what I will do. I'm gonna keep that up there for now. Finish the proof over here. we'll do case one. Case two is, it's an extremely similar argument. In fact, if you can prove case one, then you can apply case one to the function negative f to handle case two. So just imagine, you know, flipping the graph upside down. So if you can prove one of the cases, it's easy to deduce the other. So I'll just do case one. Okay. So we have a maximum value. All right. So intuitively, we have this kind of picture here. And C is going to be P. Here's the maximum. That's what we want to show, that yes, there really is a horizontal tangent there. Okay. And let's call M the slope of F at C. Right? We're assuming that the function is differentiable in the interior. Right? We're avoiding this case. And we're in the interior, so we can approach this point C from both the left and the right. Okay. So let's write out the difference quotient that defines the derivative. So we're going to write out f of x minus f of c over x minus c. And this goes to that number n as x approaches c, both from the right and from the left. Now, anywhere in this closed interval, f of x is less than or equal to f of c, because we chose c to be p, which is where f takes its maximum value. Well, if f of x is less than or equal to f of c, then this numerator up here is negative. Okay. Or at least not positive. Okay. So we have a non-positive numerator. And then what about the denominator? Well, with the denominator, its sign depends on whether x is to the left or to the right of c. As x approaches c from the left, x minus c is less than 0. So f of x minus f of c over x of c will be a non-positive number, so 0 or negative, divided by a negative number. So the result has to be either 0 over negative or negative over negative. So positive or 0. Okay, so as we approach c from the left, This direction, which converges to M, will always be non-negative. Okay? So that you can't have a bunch of non-negative numbers, you know, all at least 0, tend to something strictly negative, like negative 1 or something. Because if you make your epsilon really small, they're not going to get within epsilon of negative 1, because they're all above 0. Or at 0. They won't get close enough. And that's the function analog of the limit location theorem. Right? If you have a limit of things that are all at least, if you have a sequence of things that are all at least 5, the limit has to be at least 5. Same thing with functions. Right? Taking those kind of limits. Okay. So this number n is not negative. Now, if you do the same thing the other way, right? You approach c from the right. Well, now x minus c is positive. And but f of x minus f of c will still be non-positive. So it's either going to be a negative number up here divided by a positive number, or it's going to be 0 divided by a positive number. So either it's going to be 0 or positive over negative, which is negative. So from the right, the difference quotients are a bunch of either 0 or negative numbers. So by the function version of the limit location theorem, right, this was discussed in chapter 14, we get that m is not positive either. So m is not negative and it's not positive, so m must be 0. Just flip the graph upside down and do basically the same argument in case 2. Right? And in the picture, right, you can imagine, you know, this totally matches the picture, right? If x is to the left, right, the slope of the secant line has to be positive. If x is to the right, the slope of the secant line has to be negative, because we're dealing with the maximum value in the middle. So the slope of the tangent line, which we're assuming really exists there, has to be a limit of positive slopes from the left and negative slopes from the right. So it's got to be 0. We cheated here with the corner, right? This could always be, you know, slope positive 1. This could always be slope negative 2. And there is no limit value in the middle. But if there is a limit value, it's got to be 0.
If you want to prove the mean value theorem, all you have to do is take the function that describes this line, subtract it from f, like I said, and
then you just apply Rolle's theorem to the result. Now, you should be able to get a formula for that line because you know two points on the line. One point has x-coordinate a, y-coordinate f of a. Another point has x-coordinate b and y-coordinate f of b. You can also express it in terms of the slope in one of the points, right? Now we can prove the mean value. So L will be that secant line. So let's say I did the point slope formula. So this, the y coordinates in this line would be of the form the initial height at, say, the left end, and then plus the slope m times the horizontal displacement.
So go some x minus a over here to x, and you have to go up by m times as much.
And then just subtract that off of f, and it'll transform the problem into a Rolle's theorem problem. This function L is very nice. It's continuous and differentiable everywhere. So if I subtract it off from f, right, subtraction doesn't break continuity or differentiability. Right? So we can apply Rawls' theorem to G, in the sense that, you know, it will be continuous from end to end, differentiable in the interior. What about the endpoints? Is after we subtract this stuff off, is it zero? Yes. Because L of A, as you can check, plug in an A there, you get F of A. And what about L of B? Well, you get M times B minus A, but what is M? That's just that slope of that line. So you multiply the B minus A by the M, and that's just the vertical displacement from end to end. So that'll just do exactly what you want to take you up to F and B. Okay? So just as in the picture, F and this, I'm calling this line L, they start and end at the same height. Okay? So if I subtract them, I get a function that starts and ends at zero. G to get C strictly between A and B with G prime C 0. So after subtracting the line, we get a horizontal tangent. Okay? Well, but G is just F minus L. So if G prime is 0, that means F prime minus L prime is 0. Well, that means that F prime is L prime at C. But you know the derivative of this function, right? Constant plus constant multiple of X minus A. Right? The derivative of this thing is M everywhere. So that's it. So all the interesting stuff, at least from my perspective, is in Rawls' theorem. That's where you're fundamentally, you know, you're actually using deep properties about continuity, like the extreme value theorem, and using the definition of derivative. And this is just a little, bit of algebra and geometry. Just, you know, shift the graph. Okay. So that's how we prove the mean value theorem. We'll do a more general version of that that involves higher derivatives when we get to chapter 17, Taylor's theorem, called extended mean value theorem, extended Rawls theorem, where you do quadratic approximations, cubic approximations, instead of just, you know, approximating a function by a tangent line. Any questions about the mean value theorem? So, standard way of proving L'Hopital's rule is with something called the Cauchy mean value theorem. And this is a little bit more delicate than the mean value theorem. I'll show you why it needs a little bit more. Let's see. Make sure I get
set of hypotheses.
I think it's just, yeah, continuous from end to end, differentiable in the interior, and the one extra thing is that I have a one function that can't have a horizontal tangent in the interior. Okay, so you take the hypotheses for the mean value theorem, but now we have two functions. Here's Cauchy's mean value theorem. So if f and another function g are continuous from end to end, a, a,
on closed interval AB. And they are differentiable in the interior. And everywhere in the interior, we avoid horizontal tangents on G. Then there exists a C in the interior where F, instead of taking the change in F divided by the change in X, like we did there, F of B minus F of A over B minus A, now we take the change in F divided by the change in G. Okay. So we take average change of F, I guess you could say average rate of change of F with respect to G, right? So total change in F divided by total change in G is now going to equal an instantaneous rate of change of F divided by an instantaneous rate of change of G at a common point C, okay? Now, you could say, well, wait a minute. If I just took, you know, F of B minus F of A over B minus A, and then divided that by G of B minus G of A over B minus A, those would cancel. So why not just use the mean value theorem twice? Problem is, the mean value theorem, for each function, it gives you a C, but it doesn't promise to give you the same C every time. Right? I could apply the mean value theorem to F and know that I get a certain C, you know, but then I apply it to G and I might get a different C. But I need to have this, the Cauchy mean value theorem claims you can have the same C, that this will actually work. Now to get this, you need a better inverse function theorem. At least that's the way I like to prove. So we've already talked about an inverse function theorem. Back in chapter 12, I think. So we can use that, we can apply it to G because G is continuous, which that theorem needs, and also G prime is never zero. By the mean value theorem, if you have any function, you know, phi, right? And it's continuous on, you know, some closed interval. And let's say that it's differentiable and say it has positive derivative, right? Right, then you can get an intermediate point. This is positive, and this is positive.
So if you ever have a function and that's continuous from end to end, differentiable in the interior, and the derivative is always positive in the interior, then you know, hey, wait, not from end to end, I must go up, right? Because the total change from end to end will be equal to some instantaneous rate of change times the change in x, right? This is just taking I could have written this as a fraction, right? You can always take this fraction and multiply by the denominator in the equation of the mean value theorem. So you can generalize those, right? So if phi is continuous on an interval I don't care whether it's open or closed, or half closed. And phi is greater than zero slope on the interior of I. Then you could restrict this interval I to the closed subinterval from alpha to beta for any alpha and beta that you want, and apply this argument. So you can use this. It's a special case. You can argue that the function is strictly increasing. So when you're looking over there, you can allow yourself to use the fact that, let's say we're in the case where this is always positive. We know it's never zero. There might be some concern about can it switch signs somehow. An easy way to avoid that is to just assume that the derivative is actually continuous, so you know it'll never. And then by the intermediate value theorem, you know that if it switched sign, it would hit zero, but you assume it doesn't. So let's see here. The proof of Cauchy's mean values theorem, let's say we're in the case where G prime is, okay. So what you need to use is the inverse function. So G is continuous, and from end to end, and if it's got a positive derivative, then it'll be strictly increasing. Okay? So that means there exists an H equal to G inverse. Right? That maps from G of A, G of B, back onto AB. And this H is continuous. Now, moreover, chapter 15, chapter 14, easy thing, if you have inverse functions, okay, the derivatives are reciprocals, and that's easy to see graphically. Well, you have to clarify what you mean by the derivatives are reciprocals. I mean, okay, here's the diagonal. You imagine, here's, say, G, and then I take the reflection about the diagonal over here. Okay, there's H. Now, if I have a point X, I plug into G, then up here, I've got that same X now, but I'm thinking of it as a Y coordinate. On the other hand, over here, I've got G of X. And then, since it's a reflection about the diagonal, here I've got G of X. Okay. Now, when you do this reflection, geometrically at least, it's clear that the slopes are reciprocals. And there's an easy proof given in chapter 14. Of course, if the slope of G was zero, we would be in trouble, right? But if the slope is not zero, then... Okay? So let's see if we can parse this out. So you plug in G of X in here. And the slope of the inverse function will be the reciprocal of the slope over there. Sense? Let's think about this. So what does H do? H starts from this interval from G of A to G of B, then it maps that to A of B, and then F will map this interval to some other interval, you know, some subset of the real line, right?
Okay.
So this does make sense. Right? This is well defined. Right? And the H, I mean, is continuous from chapter 12, differentiable in the interior from chapter 14. Okay, and then when you f is differentiable in the interior, now you have to be careful. Interior of what? Right? H is differentiable in the interior of this interval, and then f is differentiable in the interior of this interval. So, but anyways, the point is when you compose them by the chain rule, this will be differentiable in the interior as well. Keep going. What about continuity? Again, composition, continuous functions, continuous. Okay. So we can apply it. What do we get? Let me call the number D. But it's not going to be the final number. So it's between G of A and G of B. And it has the property that F of H of B minus F of H of A. Is that right? No. The endpoints, you gotta be careful. F of H of G of A minus F of H of G of B over the B minus A. Okay. Over G of B minus G of A equals the derivative of the composite function at D. Okay.
Hmm.
looks a little daunting, but a lot of stuff simplifies, okay? First of all, h and g are inverse functions, so they just cancel each other out, okay? So the left side is actually what we want. F of b minus f of a over g of b minus g of a. Okay? What about the right side? Well, we use the chain rule. So it's going to be f prime of h of d multiplied by h prime of d. And I'm going to define this as just my C. Now notice that G is strictly increasing, so it's inverse. H is also strictly increasing. So I know that this will be strictly between A and B, because H sends these endpoints to A and B, and so this being in between, H will also map it to something in between A and B. So there is no... No worry there, right? Because we know we're taking the inverse of function g that's strictly increasing by this argument over here. And okay, so what happens now? Okay, so we've got f prime at c, and what do we know about this? Let's see, h prime. What have I got here? Well, remember, if h and c, or h and g are inverses, right? So if c is if c is h of b, then g of c has to be d, right? Because they're inverses. G undoes H. Right? So if you apply H and get to C, then if you apply G, you go back to D. But then, since H has this reciprocal slope property with G, this right here, when we get H prime at G of some number, that's just the reciprocal of G prime at that number. So we finally get the other side that we wanted. Okay. Graphically, you can interpret this as a parametric curve. Where, say, f is the y-coordinate, g is the x-coordinate, and the inputs to f and g are a time coordinate. And again, you know, even with a parametric curve. The picture that we had drawn earlier for the mean value theorem section. So you can imagine something. Here's something. So even if it's a parametric curve, you still have fundamentally the same picture of you draw the line here, it has a slope given by this, you know, f of b minus f of a over g of b minus g of a, and then there are places with a matching slope, tangent line slope on the curve. Right? So intuitively, it should be true. So basically, what I did was, you know, under my hypotheses, what I can do is I can invert g, so it allows me to reduce this to the case where it really is some function. You know, this.
to reduce it back to the mean value theorem case. And this is what you use to prove the versions of L'Hopital's rule, because you know that for C close to some target point, the F prime over G prime would be close to some number L. And then, if the book covers one of these cases in chapter 15, say F of A and G of A, say they're just zero, right? Then this would just be F of B over G of B equaling this. So if C and B are both close to us, the target thing, then they have to go to the same limit. Great. But we are out of time. Okay. Any questions or things regarding Thursday? Okay. See you then.